The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, if you were going to design the perfect city, you would have to include, no doubt, churches, as well as civic and public buildings, a jail, a hospital, a fire station. You'd have to include, no doubt, VD clinics and all of the public services we need in today's society, and you would no doubt have to include a city dump. You know, it's interesting that all well-balanced, well-designed cities have city dumps on the one hand, and then, of course, they've got all of these clinics and hospitals and churches and public buildings and institutional-type buildings, educational ones, on the other hand. It wouldn't be a complete city without it. As a matter of fact, years and years ago, when I was attending one of the American Association for the Advancement of Science meetings in New York City, I heard Mr. Herman Kahn, Dr. Kahn, who is the head of the Hudson Think Tank, or was at that time, discuss the perfect city of the future. And in that perfect city of the future, he was going to have not only all the constituents of the present city in which you might live, talking about urban sprawl and megalopolises and huge cities, which he said would be like Bosnia Wash to extend all the way from Boston to Washington, cities like Chippets all the way from Chicago to Pittsburgh, or San, he dubbed it, going all the way from San Francisco to San Diego, nothing but solid city. And he began to talk about how to have a complete city, you would also have to have a place for a certain number of criminals. And in planning this city of the future, clear on up into the next century, he was talking about how life would be so totally different than today. People were speculating at that particular meeting in the Association for the Advancement of Science about living in glass or plexiglass domes, of farming the sea, of traveling to outer planets, of breezing or whisking across the United States or even across the ocean in a matter of moments in our private rocket ship. So there was a great deal of futuristic type thinking. But it was interesting in all this thinking that no matter how far forward they tried to project city life, no matter how futuristic they're thinking about humankind in the next decades on beyond us, they always had to include the basic inherent evil in human nature. They had to admit or to acknowledge there would be criminals and a place for such criminals to be housed. There would be a need for all of the human diseases, maybe even more bizarre forms than we know today, and places to treat them. In all such futuristic studies, even the idea of a space age Noah's Ark that people have proposed, you never can get away from the old human element, can you? Because after all, the predominant ruling attribute in all of this world in which we live today, all of human society, is just plain old human nature. And most people still don't seem to know what is human nature, just what are we as human creatures. We know that basically we're on a giant cradle to the grave ego trip. No matter how much God's word might say, "Let another's lips praise thee," most of us spend a lot of our waking time in things we create and produce, things that we talk, pleasant cocktail or luncheon conversation, lauding and praising, extolling, bragging about, and advancing the virtues of ourselves. It has been found in the profile of a criminal that the average criminal is on an ego trip. He thinks the world owes him a living. When you find his hopes and dreams, his desires, his hang-ups and frustrations, you will find an exact overlay, like a superposition of character, with the average common American man. As a matter of fact, studies into the criminal mind tend to show nothing more than a profile of the average American man. That is, studying American criminals, presumably the average Canadian man, if it's a Canadian criminal, or the average South African man, if that applies. But human nature is the thing that we can't seem to solve, that we can't seem to get rid of, that we can't seem to overcome. Human nature is vanity, primarily. That's made clear in the Word of God, which, after all, is a book about human nature. Humankind tells us who and what we are, why we are on the earth, and where we are going, the advanced purpose for all of humankind, our great, unlimited, and incredible potential is all explained, yet most people casually peruse a little part here or there for inspiration, a little bit of poetry, a touch of the Psalms now and then, maybe go to church and listen to some very, very wonderful verbiage about Jesus, what a wonderful man he was, but a lot of people have begun to worship Jesus without ever really understanding or obeying the message that he brought. They have lauded and extolled the person, but they have rejected the message that he brought, which is the message of coming world-ruling government. But the very basic essence of human nature is, first of all, self. Everything as it relates to you, you in the very real sense of the word, are at the center of the universe, because everything that you think or know or say or do extends in all directions equidistant away from you. Wherever you are is the center of things. Your hopes, your wants, your wishes, your desires, your creature comforts are first and foremost in your mind. Now, there are notable exceptions. Once in a great while, a person will actually end up dead in striving to save someone else. There have been noteworthy exceptions on the battlefield of a buddy who literally flung himself on a hand grenade to save many others who were around, thus sacrificing his own life and taking the blow of an explosion. There have been very noteworthy cases of great sacrifice where it had to do even with one's time, as in the case of people nursing a handicapped or a crippled person. But the run-of-the-mill person who is comfortable and well-fed hasn't too much time for those things. He more or less is thinking almost constantly of self. You know, the Bible talks a great deal about self. It talks a great deal about human nature. The Bible is not only a book about human nature, it's a book against it. You might say that if you were to walk up to Jesus Christ of Nazareth and ask him, "Are you for or against human nature?" he would say, "I'm against it." And yet, in one sense of the word, he had a hand in designing it. Now, that is a little bit of a headache until you understand some of the basic premises of the very beginning portions of the book that is called the Bible, that begins to explain exactly who and what we are as human creatures, and whether or not the world was inhabited by other creatures, by some form or forms of life, whether physical, meaning creatures that maybe crawl or swim or fly or what have you, or even some intelligent form of life, maybe even more intelligent than we. Now, there are unbelievable numbers of books, a plethora of books all over the newsstands and bookstores these days that talk about people who actually had space launching platforms. It must have been awfully crude to build them way high in the Andes. It looks more or less like just a kind of a breezeway or an old highway in an Inca or an Aztec or a Maya village somewhere, but all these types of things have been speculated about in various books that are available. But you know, the Bible actually tells you there was a kind of a pre-existence or a pre-creation prior to that day that you are ushered upon the scene, as it were, where you're given a little bit of a keyhole glimpse of the very beginning of this earth, and you're told in only about 6 chapters of the Bible all that happened from the time man first walked around on this earth up until the time of the flood. And yet before that time, in a matter of a breath of a very few words, there could be as much as 4.5, 7.5, 8.5, well, they vary, they don't even know, but there could be literally billions upon billions of years that had transpired. And you know that that's one place where science and the Bible, actually there is no place where true science and the Bible contradict. I was going to say that's one place where science and the Bible corroborate each other. There are many, many such places, especially the science of archaeology, where the archaeologist fade every time it unearths something seems to corroborate more and more the history of the Bible. But do you know that even astronomy and the biblical doctrine of the creation go hand in hand together? They literally, quite literally do. When our modern telescopes and our modern space shots and the ability to actually orbit spacecraft clear around Mars and take motion pictures, well, maybe not movies, but at least pictures that are sent back so rapidly it's almost like a motion picture, and they can then superpose one after the other in scripts, and it looks like a great giant photograph, or actually it is several hundreds or thousands of them all put together, and you can see the unbelievable landscape of some of the tortured faces of the planets in our own solar system, and they all look just about like the moon. You're looking at total destruction. It's well known that this spatial area in which we live and work in our own little space capsule protected by a canopy of air is burning up at the rate of who knows how many thousands or tens of thousands a day, the little bits and pieces of debris that are out there in space. And they're not necessarily all round. They can be any angular shape. They can come crunching down upon the Earth and sometimes big enough to make a pretty big hole. There are several. There's one giant one up in Canada. There's about a mile in diameter meteorite crater over in Arizona. But every day, space debris is finding its way into the Earth's gravitational pull and hurtling down toward Earth to be burnt up. And under certain clear nights in certain areas where the Earth moves, it is known by astronomers that we will have meteorite showers. Because certain areas of our solar neighborhood seem to have more space debris than other areas. You know how that debris got there? Is there any kind of a scientific explanation other than the Big Bang theory, the oscillating universe theory, the idea of a great, gigantic hydrogen atom exploding and producing all that you can know? Now, they claim that there are 200 billion, billion stars in the Milky Way alone. And it seems hardly a month or a year goes by anymore without reading in the newspaper in some science-like column, maybe it's almost like a science fiction column, that another entire galaxy has been discovered very recently. We were told in the newspapers another galaxy, the same size, maybe larger than our own, another 200 billion, billion stars has been discovered. What used to be thought of as tiny little stars have been discovered under modern radio telescopes and far better devices, especially with space shots going out and outside of the bending of rays of the Earth's atmosphere, and have given us very clear pictures of what is out there. And the new science of being able to determine many things of these astral bodies by the various spectra of light, the energy that is given off, the heat and the light, the speed at which various rays travel. And so we look out into the space around us in all directions from us, and we see debris. The moon, an empty hulk, tortured, battered, huge craters, 50, even 100 miles wide, with hundreds or thousands of others inside of them. Craters within craters by the score and the dozens. The face of Mars, about the same. While some still like to cling to the idea there may be life out there, the cameras have revealed otherwise. Mars looks just about like the moon, tortured, battered by a tremendous number of huge meteorites or meteors that have smashed into the planet's surface that have left it a pockmarked empty hulk. Now, where did all this debris come from? How did it get there? There had to be a time when all of that happened. It's not happening now. The moon, while you can talk in terms of space, is very, very ancient, now they're beginning to think, because of exploration of the lunar surface and bringing back to Earth lunar rocks and material, that the moon was born about the same time the world was born. And I would certainly want to subscribe to that theory. Sounds quite logical. They're probably about the same age. And they probably at one time might have looked about the same. Did you ever wonder about that? As to whether or not they equally were just about as totally destroyed. But something happened to recreate or to redesign or to make so beautiful and so tremendously hospitable to life that the Earth is teeming with life, and we call it an ecosystem. The entirety of this Earth absolutely teems with life, from birds in the air and bacteria that float around to the life-giving gases, primarily oxygen, that we as humans breathe to oxidize the blood in our lungs. We are at the very middle of the ecosystem. We have only to stoop to the most shallow waters where the most abundant of all the fisheries abide. We have only to reach at the very lowest of the lands where the most abundant of all of the crops grow. On up higher, it's inhospitable. Nothing grows on and beyond a certain number of feet, 12,000 to be safe. You can get above timberline. You can't harvest vegetables up there. The deeper you go in the sea, the fewer and the more bizarre the life forms. Man finds himself right in the very middle of the ecosystem on the Earth, and the Earth finds itself in the most hospitable place in the entirety of the solar system, of the Milky Way, and so far as we know, of the entirety of the universe, and there is life upon it. Did you ever wonder about What kind of a battle in faith? Or was it an accident? Could have created all that unbelievable wasteland we see out there in space around us? Now, you know, if you were a first-time visitor from an outer spatial planet of some kind and ushered on the scene at about 1945 in, say, August, and could take an airplane trip across Europe, you could probably come to certain conclusions. You could be flying in an aircraft. Maybe they could put you in a bomb bay where you could get a real good look, or out in the plexiglass nose where the bomb site would be located, and you could look at all the cities like Essen and Mainz and Koblenz and Wuppertal. You could fly over Berlin and Köln, and you could see nothing but destruction as far as your eye could see. Shattered buildings, rubble, pockmarked with huge bomb-like craters. And you could come to some conclusions. You could say, well, it couldn't have started that way. That's an impact of a bomb or explosion. Somebody destroyed all this. You would be right. Now, when you look at the surface of the moon, even through a pair of family-sized normal binoculars, you can see a tremendous number of those huge craters up there. You know, at one time, the moon didn't look that way. It looked a lot different than that. But yet, it looks that way today. Now, how in the world did all of that take place? Science has various speculations about the origin of the universe, and of course there are, in this case, arguments between science and the Bible. The Bible says, in the beginning, God, and science says, in the beginning, was the hydrogen atom. Science says, when a theologian might say, in the beginning, God created, they say, hold on, wait a minute. Now, you can't do that. You can't say, in the beginning, God, where did you get God? Where did your God come from? But then science turns around, wipes its mouth smugly, and says, in the beginning was the hydrogen atom. And I say, hold on, just a minute there. Where did you get the hydrogen atom? The idea seems to be there was a hydrogen atom, and it exploded. Well, by what force did it explode? What law made it explode? And it went out. It did. Why not implode and go in? But it went out. What is it that made it go out in all directions, all of this debris, and they claim it is still retreating at a certain rate? The oscillating theory has it that eventually it will reach some outer limit of who knows how many trillions or quadrillion, quintuplin, quadrillion, trillion, billion, kajillion, million, thousand, 10 or 20 light years, and then it will all turn around and come rushing at about the same speed back in together and impact into one gigantic hydrogen atom. And it won't be able to stand all of that for some reason. It'll blow up and we'll start the whole process all over again. Not you and I. We won't be here, of course. Which reminds me of Professor Smedley, who was bent over viewing some fascinating heavenly body. In this case, he was not looking at Playboy. He was staring into his telescope. And he leapt away from the telescope and went rushing across the planetarium and tearing in his hair, and said, oh, ghastly, he said, the horrible thing is going to happen. One of those planets out there is going to collide with the Earth in about 100 billion years. And his cohort there began to get very agitated, excited. He said, what did you say? He said, I said, one of those astral bodies out there, I've determined, is going to collide with the Earth in 100 billion years. He says, oh, thank heavens, I thought you said 100 million years. Well, we think in terms of lifespan, or decades, or weeks, or minutes, or months, and we just don't like to think in terms of hundreds of millions of years. But the world has been here for perhaps 4.5 billion. And that's a guess. How does science know? They don't know one way or the other. But when science starts talking about, in the beginning was the hydrogen atom, and then came a giant explosion, and then came the principle by which all of these bodies, just like dropping lead in a fixed environment to create chilled shot, you know, that's the way they do for bird shot, for shotguns. They have little spouts or spigots, and the molten lead is dropping through there, and as it drops, it forms perfectly round in the air, and the water droplets will do the same thing. You can see it happen. If there'd be any way to actually stop it through photography, you could see it more clearly. Because the molecules just cause it. Don't ask me, I'm not a scientist, but it happens that way. Why are all these bodies out there so perfectly round? They claim that a cue ball, if you expanded it to the same size as the Earth, even the most polished ivory cue ball you could ever look at would have little tiny microscopic cracks that when you made it 25,000 miles around, it would have great rift valleys and mountains that would be far steeper and more dangerous and more precipitous than anything that is on this Earth of ours today. The Earth from out there in space, as we have seen from our own cameras brought back by our American space walkers and men who have been on the moon, lunar researchers have shown the Earth to be absolutely perfectly round. Now, we know it's not quite perfectly round. It bulges just a little bit at the equator and is perhaps a little flatter the other way around. But at any rate, the Earth is not exactly, if they measure it correctly, as round as it could be. But what principle causes that? Why isn't the moon all lopsided like a huge chunk? It's got some giant bodies that are buried deep beneath it. You know, this one meteorite crater, it is over in Arizona, where this meteor struck it over there and made about a mile in diameter impact mark. They claim they have never even found that meteorite. It went so deep, who knows, maybe it went a mile or two, I don't know, deep into the bowels of the Earth, and it may have impacted it a certain direction, and so all the drilling has never recovered or discovered one bit of where that body went. Can you imagine how deeply buried in the surface of the moon some of those gigantic bodies may have been, which made a crater 50 miles or more wide? It's almost incalculable. The human mind rebels at such thoughts. Well, it all had to become to be that way. And you know, the story is given you in the very first few verses of the book of Genesis, where it says, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth became without form and void, and the darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, and God said, let there be light, and there was light." You don't even have to know the Hebrew language to check in the Bible itself, back in the book of Isaiah, and to find that the Bible plainly says that the earth was not originally without form and void. They're funny-sounding Hebrew words, T-O-H-U and B-O-H-U. If we know how to pronounce them, which we probably don't, Tohu and Bohu, which mean without form and void, or empty, chaotic, vain, or waste, not fit to be inhabited. And the Bible plainly says, in the beginning, God created, and that word is bara in the Hebrew, to bring into existence, not to remake or to refashion, the heaven and the earth, and the earth became, it was destroyed, it somehow became empty, void, vain, waste, uninhabitable, but originally it was not that way. Now the 14th chapter of the book of Isaiah and the 28th of Ezekiel actually explain what happened. Because believe it or not, there was pre-human life on the earth. And it was the kind of life that even today still exists and exists on the earth that is not seen by the human eye. A kind of life that every now and then begins to interfere in private individual lives and sometimes even take over and use human minds and brains and mouths. A kind of life that many people are totally unaware of, but they ought to be aware of, because it's something to fear, something to beware of, something to be protected from. The Bible explains that there was a great archangel whose name was Lucifer, who rebelled, and that there literally was a battle in space, that there was a battle for supremacy, not only of Earth, but of the universe. And that great archangel was cast back down to this earth along with one full third of the angels that followed him. And there was a great gigantic struggle. Now that's something that defies human imagination, but then, you know, when you look at the destruction on the surface of some of those planets, that defies human imagination so far as wondering what it would have been like when it happened. But I submit to you that you can go to various places on this earth-tortured surface and look at what happened in the mountain-building era, perhaps following the great flood. If you believe in the flood, doesn't matter whether you do or not. You can prove that by the hundreds upon hundreds of billions of cubic yards of proof and testimony in the rocks themselves, and the fact that the broad majority of all rocks on the earth are sedimentary and therefore water deposited, and that most of the earth is actually water. The surface of the earth is mostly water. That's no big problem for someone to prove that they really wanted to. But you can look at the torturous twisting of some of the mountain ranges of this earth, at the great rift valleys that have been cleaved open just exactly like the loaf of bread that might bake in the oven to swell until it bursts at the top. You can look at the great rifts, at the flaws and the faults, not only all over the land surface, but even underneath the ocean. You can look at the great mountains and valleys, the entire mountain chain that begins in the Aleutians and comes down through the Rockies and the Andes, the tip of Tierra del Fuego, and clear on back around up into Asia, that from the Aleutians goes across into Asia, finds its way all the way across Siberia and Russia, down into the Pamir Knot and the mountains of Armenia, across into the Carpathians, the Alps, and ends up in the Pyrenees, thus separating Europe from Spain. And really, in one sense of the word, that is all, with just a few breaks, such as the Bering Straits and one or two mountain passes like the Khyber and the Bosporus Dardanelles, that is one giant, continuous mountain chain. You can look at the shape of this earth, and you know there was a time when there was mountain building, when the very continents themselves were moved out of their places, when this earth didn't look the way it does today. It's been proved by fossil ripple marks, for example, that the ocean has known several different levels. I'm talking in terms of hundreds or even thousands of feet, not 5 or 10 or 15. And even the story of coral atolls and the way they are built also proves that the ocean has known many different levels. At one time, there may have been a land bridge all the way from the area of southern China, clear across what is today Indonesia, the Philippines, and clear to Australia. Yet today, that shallow area is all covered by water, with thousands of islands instead. There may have been a land bridge across what is now the Bering Strait, between the Soviet Union and the United States territories out there at the end of the Aleutians, or better said in this case, up in the northern part of Alaska. Now this earth is quite a fascinating study of destruction, of mountain building, of a time when this earth had far more water on it, as testimony given by the thousands of dry lake beds, some of which are many, many miles wide. The Great Salt Lake, for example, is a tiny puddle in what used to be one of the most gigantic, gargantuan in-water lakes you could ever imagine, and the lake shore marks are still there. The same thing is true in upstate New York. The same thing is true all over the Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado deserts of the United States. I shouldn't call Colorado desert country, perhaps. And people might take offense. But there was a great destruction, a great rebuilding, and then man came upon the scene much later. And that story is one of the most fascinating of all, because it has to do with the origin of humankind, but it also has to do with the very origin of the universe, with the earth, the solar system, and the great creator being who himself is working out a purpose and a plan here below, and the fact that there still exists on this earth the very creature who was able, with his own cohorts and the ones who followed him in his rebellion, to bring such unbelievable destruction, not only upon the earth, but all of space, that you can see and know. He is Satan the devil. He is real. He does exist. He does live. I'm going to have to break off there for lack of time, but if you want something on that subject, you can sure have it writing in for this booklet, Does God Exist?, and the other one entitled Satan's Fate. You may be out of those temporarily, but if so, we'll get you something on that subject. Write to the current number of The Plain Truth while you're at it, and get this television and radio log, and also these current articles, Reactor Sales, Shortcut to Nuclear Nightmare, and The Roots of American Success, and How Greece Bids for Common Market Membership. That's in the current Plain Truth. It's absolutely free of charge. And all you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales.